The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. My name is Anne-Marie Sheedy, Global Partnerships Director at ExchangeWire. And this week, I'm joined by my colleague, Matt Broughton, Senior Editor. Hello, Matt.
Hello. How are you, Anne-Marie?
I'm wonderful, Matt.
Excellent.
And we're delighted to be joined by Nikki Chana, board member of the Women in Programmatic Network. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Hi, Matt. Pleasure to be here. Hope you're both well.
Yes, we are. It's Thursday. The sun isn't out in London, but it's not raining. It's not bad for the end of September.
That's a bonus.
So let's crack on. The first story we'd like to talk about is UK broadcasters, BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Channel 5 are close to reaching a deal to launch a new joint streaming service. This is according to details published in The Telegraph. The new service, which would be branded under the Freeview banner, has reportedly been devised ahead of a new production run of smart TVs, due for release in 2023. Prior to rollout on other CTV hardware devices such as Roku and pay TV platforms. Sky, one of the key stakeholders in the Freeview program, is preparing to launch its own range of branded smart TV devices. So it'll be on a single homepage, accessed either directly through the app or by taking viewers through to the broadcaster's own platforms, such as BBC iPlayer, ITV Hub, All4 and My5. If agreed, it would come less than 2 years after the launch of BritBox, an SVOD service focusing on television series and films, which currently operates within the UK, US, South Africa, Canada, and Australia. Now, there was a previous joint initiative, Project Kangaroo. I want to know who comes up with these names. That's an online TV service which fell through in 2009, having been blocked by the Competition Commission over its potential ramifications for the emerging UK streaming market. So broadcasters and other European nations have also been experimenting with joint initiatives in an attempt to regain market share from the US giants such as Netflix and Disney+. Most notably, the proposed merger between French ad-supported TV firms TF1 and M6. Now, Nikki, I'm going to come to you first. What do you think does the new service mean for broadcasters, individual platforms, as well as BritBox?
I think it's quite an interesting initiative. And going back to your point, I wonder who thinks of the names. I was going to actually ask, I wonder what it would be called if it actually does go ahead. Also, what will happen to the BBC's TV license? But in sort of relation to your question, I think it could potentially take away from broadcaster individual viewership. So, for instance, you've got the main sort of UK broadcasters wanting to come together and facilitate all this content within sort of, let's say, one hub. But then what happens to the identity of each broadcaster? That's sort of what sprung in my mind. And in terms of, let's say, viewerships and engagement in that respect, I think it really depends on what users are used to watching, where they're used to watching it, and when. Also, accessibility of, let's say, content. So the content being sort of delivered through these main broadcasters, let's say, within this hub, if it goes ahead, will that be readily available across other sort of streaming devices? And in terms of, let's say, European or non-US broadcasters trying to regain the market share from, let's say, Netflix or Disney, I think that is, again, quite a strong collaborative initiative by Geo, let's say. But then you've got Netflix, you've got Disney, which are two global names, but then their content's so different in comparison to what we're getting through our, let's say, UK broadcasters, for instance. And Netflix and Disney, you know, as two separate platforms, have really different content. So again, I think it goes back down to what the user's sort of really actually into and where they're actually used to viewing their content. But as you mentioned, I've actually got here as well, TF1 and M6 did it in that respect, which creates more scale and it creates more market share. But I don't particularly think Netflix or Disney or let's say like an Amazon, for instance, will sort of go in the background or anything. They'll be very much prominent, but with the broadcasters would have more of a market share. But again, I think because the content's so different, mergers do make sense rather than having many individual broadcasters. But I think only time will tell in terms of the actual viewerships, the engagement rates, and the level of users actually signing up.
Yeah, that's true. And the good old kind of subscription fatigue as well. How many people are going to sign up to how many different platforms?
Exactly.
What do you think, Matt?
I completely agree with that point. I think in terms of they've already got initiatives such as Freeview Play, which is a cross collaborative effort from the broadcasters. There's also the competing UView. So I'm not sure where this would sit in comparison to those platforms because they ostensibly cover the exact same niche. When reading through the story, to me, it looked like it was being pushed by Sky, as it's very much an approach they're trying, like, you know, they've been acquired by Comcast, and Comcast are trying that approach in the US with their sort of integrated smart TV models. So they're definitely looking more towards the sort of hardware element, kind of echoing Nikki's point in terms of where each of the respective broadcasters, where their benefits are. I think privatization of Channel 4, that's probably where they're looking at. In terms of just trying to be featured on as many platforms as possible. Channel 5, I would assume they're just trying to be featured wherever possible. Broader is better for them. But in terms of the likes of ITV Hub and in particular, I'm not sure in terms of where the advertisers that they're currently working with on ITV Hub, where they would see this. Would they be kind of miffed that they're cannibalizing their views? Especially if it, you know, if it is an integrated smart TV, that's always going to be the option for viewers to press that button and launch that platform rather than ITV Hub, which those marketers are paying for.
And that actually brings me to the point that it's really interesting to see that the channels are having conversations like this, because, you know, traditionally it would be almost who's got the market share of the UK viewership, for instance, and just using the UK as an example. So you had ITV, see the BBC, etc. And I think that will be quite interesting to see. And obviously the individual subscription or pricing models each broadcaster has. And then it just reminds me of, again, like Christmas time, for instance, where, I mean, in terms of viewership and wanting eyeballs and, you know, sort of channels, content, etc., how will that be sort of looked at, measured, etc.? And, you know, your point about BritBox, that's around 2 years, less than 2 years old, and that's powered by ITV and BBC. So will that almost dissolve into or be a part of this initiative or project, or will it remain a separate subscription service that's available outside of the UK? A potential focus could actually be on all things outside of the UK. So that will be quite interesting to see in terms of where that goes, because as we sort of previously mentioned, you are able to license and get content across other sort of distributors, obviously depending on what the content is and who it is. So it is quite an interesting initiative. But then, you know, the identity of each channel, as users get more familiar, let's say, with the app, or as we grow up in the digital world, will these channels be seen as individual channels or broadcasters, let's say, or will they be perceived as one UK viewing hub, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because if you have kind of loyal BBC viewers versus Channel 5, you know, that to me, the content is very different on those channels. I don't know what's on Channel 5. Is Home and Away still on there? I don't know. Is there Hallmark films at 3 o'clock? Or I don't know. But I think another area I'd like your views on is, you know, how important will integrations with smart TV devices and other forms of hardware be to streaming platforms?
I think important, very, very, very important. And with that goes with ensuring that not only the integrations, but the measurability sort of is there as well. So being able to measure, you know, what goes on in a way behind the scenes, let's say, in terms of viewers. If you think about it, we live on our phones, we live on TVs, let's say, through TVs, devices. Most households have a smart TV, and those that don't, you're able to turn your TV into a smart TV with a device. So hardware is key, definitely. But again, it's quite new, and too many distribution channels may make tracking quite difficult. So that's what I sort of think. But I think to ensure that you have a smooth integration with hardware devices such as smart TVs, Roku, etc., is super key, especially for the way we actually consume our content nowadays as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think coming back to the point in terms of how you know, hardware will help local broadcasters compete with the likes of Netflix and Disney. Netflix and Disney hardware is the one sort of niche they haven't really gone into. Obviously, in terms of Amazon, they've obviously got Fire Sticks, and Google have got Chromecast. They've looked at hardware. But Netflix and Disney Plus, apart from integrations with smart TVs, they haven't really addressed it. So I think that would be a positive step for local broadcasters to explore. The one worry I have is that it could lead to a kind of walled garden slash gaming console landscape of old, where you could say you're only able to view Disney Plus on this particular brand of television. You're only able to watch Netflix on this particular brand of smart TV. And I think that's just something that needs to be avoided within the industry.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think it's necessarily bad that Netflix and Disney don't have their own hardware devices. I think because they're quite easily accessible through our phones, through Apple TVs, as well as like my smart TV. I didn't have a smart TV before, but now I've got a smart TV that's got Netflix. That's got, I think, Netflix on it. So I don't think it's bad. I think Apple TV is a great thing. And you do have various bits of content on it. But again, it's about sort of ensuring that you've got the licenses to that content. Maybe Netflix felt that they didn't need to because they've sort of almost sort of set out their own environment and are confident that users are enjoying the new films and new series is that they're bringing out. And they will log in to watch those no matter what sort of device. Whereas I think when you've got a Fire Stick or like an Apple TV, as I previously mentioned, you can turn a TV into a smart TV. So you've got, in a way, two in one. You've got a TV, but then you've got a device that you can actually stream films through and then access various different channels. So if you think of even Rakuten TV, that's on Apple TV at the moment. I'm sure your own use has some channels as well. So it's very much content dependent. And I think smart TVs are going in the direction of accumulating more partners. You know, sort of on a global level, obviously dependent on geo. So it'll be interesting to see what Sky's smart TVs and sort of how that sort of pans out and what that looks like.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what the measurements metrics will look like as well. And you know, if I'm an advertiser and I want to target traditionally Anne Marie, who watches, I don't know, Line of Duty on BBC and is not used to getting advertising, versus Anne Marie, who perhaps might watch I don't know, Coronation Street on ITV and is very familiar with having advertising, and the caliber of advertising on ITV versus perhaps the caliber of advertising or the nature of what's being promoted on Channel 5. I have no idea. I'm Lollipop Holidays or something, I would imagine, or The Sun. I don't know. But how is that? What type of experience am I going to get watching these channels?
And that's a really, really good question. And if you think about it, especially in Europe, because we are so, the data is really important to us at production, as it is sort of really being rolled out globally, GDPR. And that sort of brings out the question. So how are you measuring users? Okay, there's opt-in data where a user will have to sign up to be a part of that channel. But again, if we've got all these channels in one environment and some are ad-funded, let's say, broadcasters versus others' licenses, how will that actually pan in? How will you be able to, you know, sort of really validate a user and the type of ad that they want to see based on just certain attributes and information that's passed back and what can be actually passed back. So that will be, I think, a really big learning curve as well. But then,
will there be advertising? Because at the moment, I'm not subscribed to BritBox, but my understanding is that if I subscribe, then I don't have to watch any ads.
No, on BritBox, you wouldn't have to. But for instance, let's say ITV or something like that. So going back to the one-stop hub shop, let's say, of UK broadcasters, ITV, they hold advertising. BritBox is a subscription, so you won't. In that respect. So I'm just wondering how that would actually look and how that would pan out.
Yeah. Matt, do you have anything else to add?
No, I think just in terms of, I think more details are needed on that last point, because where they have said sort of sketchily details on some programs may just have links to say like iPlayer, some may just be native within that single homepage. I think that will be key in terms of how that's measured. And then in terms of like the advertiser buy on, they're not necessarily going to be, if all BBC content is funneled out to iPlayer, then again, that's not going to be as appealing as having that kind of one-stop hub.
No, it's almost just having an interface where you're just directing users to what channel they want to watch, when you can see that on the smart TV or Freeview bar anyway.
Exactly.
So it's what, you know, what's going to, it's powerful, but I'm just wondering what's branding going to be? What's it going to be called? Who's going to be, let's say, the queen channel, you know, how will what will the model look like? Because these are such powerful channels and traditional and part of our lifestyle. So it's quite interesting that this has come up.
Okay, so let's move on to story two.
Cool.
This is where ByteDance has announced that Douyin users under the age of 14 will be limited to a maximum of 40 minutes per day on the app, with no access for these allowed between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. ByteDance say this is the most stringent youth protection measure in the history of the platform and follows similar settings implemented by rival platform Keishu. Is that how you pronounce it?
Keishu. Along those lines.
Which was in 2019. So at this stage, only users which have signed up to the platform using their real names will automatically operate within teenage mode, while parents are being encouraged to either manually enable the settings or add real names to the account. Now, these measures come amid a swath of social interventions brought about by Beijing, including a complete ban on for-profit tutoring in core curriculum subjects and restricting under 18s from playing video games for more than 3 hours per week. China has been notably stricter against domestic companies in recent months, following its interventions to prevent the proposed $37 billion US dollars IPO of Ant Group. So, will we see similar age and time-based restrictions implemented in other countries, for instance, in Douyin's counterpart, TikTok? What do you think, Matt?
So on this story, I think it's interesting in the sense that gaming has typically drawn these kind of restrictions previously. And then, as you said, Anne-Marie, have been subject to even stricter ones. I find it very interesting that this is now being widened to wider apps, including social apps, especially when the kind of sort of Chinese super app is something that's very much to the fore in that region. In terms of whether we'll see similar restrictions outside of China, I can't see any on this level. And if they are implemented, I can't see them being adhered to. Like, you could barely get people to wear masks at the height of the pandemic. I doubt you'll be able to stop little Johnny from signing into to TikTok and having a dance.
Sad, but true.
One thing I would say, I'm not harking for authoritarian control over businesses to the same extent that China is at all. But I think something has to be said for the way it is able to tackle malfeasance by big tech firms. Some, you know, a comparative example is the recent fine on Google by South Korea. It was $176 million over antitrust violations, which it committed over several years. That equates to, I think, something like 0.2% of its quarterly revenue. And there's little other repercussions. So I think in terms of where big tech companies are being malfeasant, I'm not saying ByteDance is here at all, or you know, gaming firms are at all. But I think that's something that just has to be flagged in terms of controlling big tech companies over here, which you know, as we've been discovering with various levels of antitrust investigations in recent years, have been operating on a bit of an out control basis.
True. And Nikki, you know, how will these measures restrict the kind of what's deemed as the rapid growth of Chinese tech companies in terms of both domestic and international activity?
So I think if it's a rule globally across Chinese tech companies, there'll be an impact. No one essentially wants to be limited in any way, shape or form, or it could go the other way. Giving parents the confidence in apps and platforms that they have their users' best interests at heart. So it could be quite, again, more so for the carer, the parent, be quite a strong, solid movement. Let's say Chinese tech companies are actually implementing to you know, help with the well-being and mental health of the users to ensure that they don't overexert themselves on apps. But in terms of growth, what Matt sort of said, it's not going to stop anyone accessing other apps, for instance, or other companies. Because if it was me, I've got what, 2 email addresses. I'll probably set up 2 accounts, for instance. Not now. I don't really use TikTok, guys, but I think it's great. I've done probably 1 video on it or 2, a little mime number. But there's other platforms out there. And I think this day and age, especially how up to date social media users are and platforms, they know when to find each other, where to find each other, and how to find each other. So it could be 40 minutes a day that users have been restricted to. But I think it could actually help other social platforms grow.
Definitely, because, I mean, it begs the question, what opportunities does this clampdown on domestic companies offer non-Chinese companies within the country? How are they going to monitor that?
No, exactly. And you know, there's a bit of both. So you've got learnings, understanding ways that the Chinese market is moving to operate. So you don't obviously want to go totally against. You want to somehow meet in the middle, but not, you know, ruin what you've got going or cannibalize anything. But you will get people finding ways around that particular roadblock across other platforms or means.
Yes. I mean, what about Johnny? Poor little Johnny, Matt. Tell us, what would he be thinking? Or Josie?
Oh, they'll be devastated. But I think one thing in terms of how Chinese tech companies will kind of react to this, I expect a lot more investment and M&A activity by those companies in firms, particularly in Europe. I think, as Nikki said, the users will look towards other platforms if restrictions have been implemented. Not necessarily saying they will in terms of TikTok, but using that as an example, they'll know these restrictions may be coming and look to invest in other similar video sharing platforms. In the US, obviously, in terms of sort of the Trump administration, they were very much against you know, investments in M&A by Chinese tech companies. But I think in, you know, the Biden era as such, it's become a lot more focused on US companies. So there may be maybe an investment or an acquisition there, but I think Chinese tech companies will look towards Europe and funnel a lot of their investment there, where they aren't necessarily as restricted as they are in their home country.
I think so too. And I think potentially US IPOs of Chinese companies could be challenging as well, the more stringent it sort of gets. And again, if it's rolled out sort of globally in terms of own companies, sort of, let's say, rules and regulations, that could be quite challenging as well, especially the US is a huge market, as is China.
Again, I suppose it's just watch this space and see how it evolves. Right then, story 3. This is about Discord, who have raised $500 million in a new financing round, according to a report published in Bloomberg. Sources say that financing gives Discord, for those who don't know this company, it's a messaging, voice chat, and community platform. And it has a valuation of $15 billion USD. So That is more than double the $7 billion USD it was apparently worth at its previous funding round in December last year. CEO Jason Citron said the funding will be used to invest in new features and tools. Then it emerged that Discord was in talks with Microsoft over a potential $10 to $12 billion sale, with other rumored suitors including Amazon and Epic Games. This offer was rejected in the spring. Early in its years, Discord primarily catered for gaming users. However, it has since pivoted to encompass other communities, including school clubs, art groups, music sharing, and general social groups. The US firm remains popular with its core gaming audience, but many official community forums for developers and gaming news publishers are now housed within the platform. Community-based social media is a hot space for investment currently, and there's heavy speculation that Reddit will IPO next year, having raised $950 million over two funding rounds this year. With that in mind, what do you think is the growth potential for Discord? How will it compete with other platforms? And how does Discord's subscription model compare with Reddit's primarily ad-funded approach? Nikki, can we go to you first on that?
Yeah, of course you can. I actually downloaded Discord yesterday. So I'm finding myself navigating through it. And I mean, the growth potential for Discord, given that they rejected an offer of $12 billion from Microsoft, huge.
Yeah.
They know that we don't know. I mean, there could be two sides of that. It could be, look, we don't want to be a part of the Microsoft library, let's say, essentially. We want to still have our own identity. We want to be Discord. They could have some information in their back pocket that we don't know about.
I don't know. I'd give up my identity for that amount of cash. Anyway.
What couldn't you do with $12 billion? You know, and it is quite a different platform. So when I looked at it and stuff, and what the interface and what it actually reminds me of is a mixture of Slack versus that house party app that came out at the beginning of lockdown.
Yes, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, so I do. It's one of the few things I remember about lockdown in the past 18 months, but yes, I do.
House party, yeah. How can we forget that? And that app was, a really controlled environment. You can invite who you want to your own house party. You've got your rooms that you can have your own conversations and chat, etc. And then you've got Slack, where with your Slack channels to separate conversations, ensure there isn't confusion. I won't go into Slack. I'm sure lots of people know what Slack is. So I actually liked the Discord app because it seemed like a mixture of those. And how will it compete with other platforms? I think it's quite exciting. It's got a Pinterest-esque sort of feel to it in a certain way.
Okay.
I think it's quite a niche app. I don't think it will scale as much as, let's say, a Facebook, Instagram, or a Snap. But again, this is me talking now in 2020. We don't know what's going to happen
to break it to you, but I think it's 2021. I know. It's okay. We've only lost the last 18 months.
Did you know?
We won't be editing that out, by the way. I'm sorry.
I'll go to the future for this podcast. You know, I'll go into the future and see what's going to happen with this report after that. But in terms of, we're in 2021 now. Apologies.
Welcome.
Right, thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. How will it compete? Thank you, and happy birthday. But how will it compete with other platforms? I think it will be quite an exciting platform, but think of platforms, like I said, like a Pinterest, platforms that actually have actual forums where, you know, users can talk, speak, discuss, rather than sharing their own stories, selfies, and what they're actually doing.
Yeah.
So I think that would, I think it'd have good growth, but in its own niche way.
Yeah, Matt, I mean, do you think it will adopt advertising similar to the hybrid model that Reddit's now favoring?
I can't see that happening. And I think that's where kind of Discord's path is a little more unclear. I think where Discord has been primarily used by gamers, they're traditionally an audience which is hesitant of advertising, particularly when it's a kind of community-based, especially kind of, you know, the voice elements of Discord. That's what, you know, I've used Discord for several years now. That's what I primarily use it for. I think where that kind of advertising model may be brought in is the in the kind of more forum element of it. But I think that kind of that the way they monetize that is where it's a little bit more unclear compared to, say, a Reddit, which obviously in terms of the hype about their IPO, I can't see Discord, for example, going down that avenue quite yet, simply while they kind of work that one out. But in terms of their user figures for Discord, it's huge. I think it's something like 300 million odd.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's just those users alone. If they can get that monetization model right with advertising, which appeals or doesn't turn off gamers, while capturing that kind of new communities which they've been broadening into over the last couple of years, I think then it could be an absolute winning prospect.
I think potentially, actually, there, Matt. The reason why I say this is because initially some of the social media platforms didn't launch with advertising. So Snapchat, they launched in 2011, and then 2014 they started running ads, and then Facebook pondered around it, and then very shortly they introduced ads. But you're right there. I think it depends on the balance and how they're actually delivered. I mean, look at things like Twitch TV, for instance. That's a massive, massive gaming platform, and they facilitate ads as well. But, you know, going back to the paid model and ad funded model, where you're able to do some of the basic things, I'm sure in Discord, I understand that there's, you can purchase, in-app purchases, let's say, I think it's around $8.99 a month. I need to look into more into what that pay.
Yeah, Discord Nitro, I think it's.
Nitro, that's it. Isn't it? Nitro, that's it. But so you have got that facility to do that. And again, like, I'm not cheap or anything like that, but I don't typically make in-app purchases ever. I don't think. And I don't think I ever.
Oh my God, there's somebody tighter than me out there.
Yeah, I don't think I ever have.
But this is that. That's what the question. You know, alluding back to you, Nikki, what you said earlier on. What if they got up their sleeve? What's in their back pocket? Because they've rejected that amount of money from Microsoft, right? So, what kind of, where does their future lie in terms of maybe funding or exit? Or they must have something mapped out in order to kind of feel comfortable to reject that amount of money. But ultimately, for me, it comes down to what's the value exchange, you know, whether or not, you know, you're tight like me, or now I can say me and my friend Nikki, or, you know, what's the perceived exchange? What's the value? Is it worth it? And that's that. Mm-hmm. Again, it's only time will tell.
Yeah, because it also depends on just Discord aside, but I'm just talking about in that purchase. It really sort of depends, because you could have an ad funded app, for instance, but you'll mm-hmm. still have to purchase, let's say, additional functions and features. And I think that's something to consider as well. But going back to these guys, Discord, yeah, must have been a huge offer. I mean, you know, I read that Microsoft, this is just in the last 21 trading days, that declined by 1.3%. So
really?
Yeah, but I'm sure that, you know, we do get fluctuations. I don't think it's down to anything to do with that. Maybe they just don't see themselves as part of the Microsoft umbrella in terms of the look and feel, messaging, or their company values, for instance.
Yes, the culture, who knows?
Yeah, yeah. I think the sort of negotiations from what I read were being led on Microsoft's front by the Xbox Live team. And I think maybe Discord, given that it's been broadening out to other communities, didn't want to lock themselves off from PC gamers who don't necessarily engage with, you know, the Microsoft gaming suite, or didn't want to be locked down to, say, just the Xbox console.
I think that's a really good point.
May be where that came from. But in terms of their future route, I think it kind of shows the way that they'll try and be a lot more open in terms of how they receive investment, whether it's still through just going through the VC rounds or eventually going through an IPO when their kind of monetization questions are a bit more clear. But I think that kind of being locked down to one particular platform, I think that's where they've probably gone, nope, don't want to be involved with that. Mm-hmm. We'll walk away.
And good for them. you know, that's great. Yeah, exactly. They're not being a slave to the dollar. Right. I'd like to move on to the second part of the webcast, which is where we have the privilege of finding out a little bit more about what you're up to, Nikki, and in particular about, I'd like our listeners to learn more about your role as board member on the programmatic and the Women in Programmatic Network. So you're in Scotland, but this is a global initiative, right?
Yes, it is. And I am indeed. So my growing up career, let's say, was in London. Decided to have a little change, and now I am in Scotland. And the Women in Programmatic is a great initiative that actually started during lockdown. It was in 2019, and there was four of us. Now,
are you sure it was 2019?
Yeah, 2018. It was 1950. No, 2019, just four of us. And now it's grown to just under 500. It's a global initiative. I know, it's honestly, it's so refreshing and so exciting just to see the sheer level of women from different parts of the world, different backgrounds in terms of, you know, within the tech and programmatic world, all types of levels. And it's just a great initiative that started for us to keep in touch, keep up to date, because we all had different backgrounds. So at the time, I was at Aegis, I believe, up in Scotland. And then I went on to Fryzen Media. But the whole point was to keep each other up to date and in the loop of, you know, what's happening in the industry. Because, you know, once upon a time, we could go to events, et cetera, and then that just died, and that will start coming up soon. But anyway, it was almost like a forum. We'd meet up once a month and we'd just talk all things hot and what's not in the industry, about our roles, about, again, new initiative, mergers, you name it, you know, typical stories you read about. And it was such a lovely group, let's say. And I'd say it's a feminine group. We're not anti-men or anything like that. But the whole point behind the Women in Programmatic is to give the stage to the network, for instance.
Yep.
There's so many opportunities out there. There's so many learning opportunities out there and so much knowledge. And what we typically do is that we encourage women to sign up globally. We're looking for regional leaders, and it's all about sharing information and just not even empowering one another. I would say empowering, but it's about personal growth and professional growth. It's about, again, you know, what topics are hot. So, for instance, we'll meet up once a month, meet up in inverted commas. Our last call, I believe we had around 50, 60 people, some from Canada, US as well, which is really exciting. And one session out of a quarter will be a learning session. So, for instance, we'll do one on identity. The next one is about fraud and ad blocking. And then we could potentially do ones on all things creative and tech, etc. So that will happen once a month, once a quarter, sorry. And then twice a quarter, which will be the other months, we'll literally meet up, overview, update the group on speaking opportunities. So we're massive advocates in, again, growing confidence and encouraging women in our network to take part in panels, podcasts, etc. And offer that. So it's a really, really good collection of all sorts of backgrounds where we can just be totally honest, share information. And going back to the two sessions, that's just literally a breakout room. So updates, information on all things that are happening. And then we'll just basically allow the people to network and just talk around subjects that they're interested in. So we'll always brief the team beforehand, give them three subjects, you know, to look at what they're interested in. And then the network members can actually choose what they want to take part in. And it's just a really strong way for so many great members in the industry to connect and feel loved in a way and really get themselves out there.
We're fantastic. So, I mean, if I'm a listener out there, how do I get in touch? Where do I go? Are you looking for people to help support this initiative? Maybe, you know, you talk about building confidence and stage presence. Are you keen to have people that perhaps have expertise in that area to get in touch and help support? Where do I go to become a member? And are there any kind of criteria that I need to be mindful of?
Just be within the programmatic industry, female. But having said that, when it comes to support, et cetera, and ways that we can just really help evangelize women in programmatic. So those that want to actually join and be a part, we've got a presence on LinkedIn. It's called the Women in Programmatic Network.
Excellent.
You can find us there. So the women space, the space women in programmatic, because sometimes it doesn't come up. So make sure you've got that space. And we've actually got our website and all information on there. You can sign up through our website.
Cool, because I'm pretty sure that we'll have people all over the world that'll be interested in sharing and learning and speaking with like-minded people and joining, and then others that perhaps could help run some of those sessions.
Oh, definitely. That would be absolutely awesome. So, for instance, you guys have been absolutely amazing in supporting us. We're speaking to the likes of VE Global in terms of marketing initiatives and events. So we are having our first, it's actually one to mention, we're having our first Women in Programmatic real life event, 7th of October. Over 70 members have signed up to attend. The venue and the information is all on the LinkedIn page. I'm going to get the URL for us now.
Cool. That's great. And that'll be in London. Then hopefully, you know, that will evolve and you'll be hosting those in different regions on a regular basis.
Exactly that. Exactly that. And the URL is literally www.thewomeninprogrammaticnetwork.com.
Perfect.
Just wanted to make sure I got that.
Does right. What it says on the tin.
Does indeed.
Brilliant. We're out of time now, but I'd really like to thank you for your input today, Nikki. And as always, Matt, thank you for your input. And to all our listeners, we hope you enjoy the podcast and we'll be back again next week. Thank you very much. Have a great day, evening, morning, afternoon, wherever you are.